welcome to this 16th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 8th chapter, titled Becoming Feminine in the Cosmos. Chapter 8, Becoming Feminine in the Cosmos. One may note right off the bat that I have no chapter titled Becoming Masculine in the Cosmos. Sorry, guys, no equal rights on this one. I do think it's important to take a different look at femininity. For eons, ever since the Garden of Eden, Eve and the snake, women have been looked on as inferior, evil, temptresses, troublemakers, and such like. Even today, many religions persecute them, make them wear ridiculous outfits, set them below men, deny them political, social, and civil equality, and forbid them to speak in church or society. I hope in this chapter to at least cast some light towards getting our collective heads screwed on straight about femininity. No mortal father with love for his children would accept seeing his daughter treated as a second-class citizen, as chattel, as nothing more than a flesh-and-blood replacement for a blow-up doll for the use, abuse, and discarding of men. It's the same with God. There are about 6,000 years of wrong that need to be addressed, and those two treatments of women, 6,000 years of wrong since Eve, and the attempt to correct those wrongs by 20th century feminists will be examined in this chapter. In America, it's only been a recent development that women finally achieved some forms of equality before the law, were allowed to own property, to pursue their talents and interests in schools and the military, and many other things. This was all good, but there are other areas of equality, especially sexual relations, that are doing great harm to our sisters and daughters. And no, I'm not going to tell women how to be feminine. I've said on many occasions that the quickest way for a man to be an idiot is to tell women how to dress, act, conduct their marriages, etc. What I do hope to do is to get us to remember Eve and our subsequent treatment of women from that story and the misuse of the idea of equality as inculcated by 20th and 21st century feminism in our society to correct the problems of our perceptions of women through Eve. When I was in radio in the 70s and 80s, I gathered bits of material to use as a discussion fodder for my show, which consisted mainly of irrelevant trivia and weirdness. One book that I remember in this context, it was written by a weightlifter, Charles Atlas wannabe, named Joe Bonomo. In this booklet, he took his life in his hands to instruct women on how to run their homes. He wrote out a daily schedule to help them get organized. I remember Thursdays in particular, quote, pour a can of drain cleaner down your drain and take the rest of the day off, unquote. In telling females how to run their lives, I doubt I could do much better. This is all from memory, folks, by the way, which we know is faulty. I can't promise much in the way of accuracy years later. Well, let's look at femininity and see what new conclusions we can reach. First, let's do away with the feminist ideas of the 20th century that men and women are the same, the only difference being in how they're raised. Men and women are not equal in the sense of two bananas being equal. They are or should be equal before the law and equal in the eyes of God. Yet their differences should be accommodated. If we're going to celebrate diversity, then let's celebrate it and not pretend it doesn't exist, while at the same time not using it as a bogus argument for keeping certain segments of people from full realization of their talents and intelligence and not benefiting from their contributions to society, be their diversity, race, ethnicity, nationality, theology, or sex. One of my favorite quotes involves a definition of a mixed marriage. Quote, it is not that he is African and she Caucasian, or that he is Hispanic and she is Oriental. It is that he is male and she is female. That is the mix of the marriage. end quote. We must move beyond the feminist silliness of the 70s and 80s that said men and women are the same, that it is all in how they've been brought up by their parents. Girls are given dolls and taught to prepare for motherhood. Boys are given trucks and soldiers and taught to prepare for manhood. End quote. There's also a curious fact, one uncovered by evolutionary biology, about the shapes of the distribution curves for most male-female differences. Darwin remarked on it, and on the fact that it holds robustly across other species too. It's that males are far more variable than females. They are overrepresented both at the top of the heap and the bottom of the barrel. Fewer women are likely to be dunces, but also fewer will be geniuses, end quote. In general, quote, being competitive, risk-taking, status-conscious, dedicated, single-minded, persevering, it can make all the difference to success, and these are qualities that men, on average, are far more likely to possess, often in alarming abundance, end quote. Pages 58 through 59, Charles Murray, Human Accomplishment. Helena Cronin, self-described feminist, writes of male and female differences in The New Humanists, Science at the Edge, a collection of essays. Quote, whether or not sexism is operating, evolved sex differences certainly will be. Differences in dispositions, skills, values, interests, and ambitions. Women are very likely to make systematically different choices from men. If your aim is to get rich, don't try selling pornography to women or romantic novels to men. End quote. Steven Pinker, a research psychologist at MIT, writes, quote, political equality consists of recognizing, as the Declaration of Independence says, that people have certain inalienable rights, namely life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Recognizing those rights is not the same thing as believing that people are indistinguishable in every respect. The New Humanist, a collection of essays, edited by John Brockman, page 36. Dennis Prager, whom I have quoted often as an author, is also a radio talk show host, and I remember, as best as faulty memory can put together, a couple conversations on his program on this topic. One was of a liberated couple who had a daughter. They gave her toy trucks instead of dolls so she could have a proper feminist upbringing. They found that she had named the trucks and was taking care of them. That story alone endeared little girls to me on a whole new order of magnitude. There is an instinctual, natural bent to nurture in females that is crucial to the life of the race. It does not make them inferior. It makes them vital, indispensable to the race. Political correctness can't stamp that out any more than we can stamp out the instinct of salmon to return to their birth stream to spawn. The second half to Prager's observations is the story of how boys were given a dollhouse and dolls to play with instead of the traditional boy toys. When looked in on shortly after, they found the boys setting the dolls on a teeter-totter, banging down on the other end of it, and catapulting them over the dollhouse. Yeah, you gotta love boys, too. And one more time with Dennis Prager. Readers will have to cut me some slack here. I listen to these radio shows and carry away snatches of conversation from which I think I have the right idea, but memory is faulty. No harm intended for Dennis Prager or Laura Schlesinger, whom I will refer to next. I heard Dennis give the example of two boxes. One has an on-off switch. That's it. The other one has dials, levers, buttons, switches, radar sensors, and who knows what else. Okay, which box is male? Which box is female? Dr. Laura Schlesinger, also a radio talk show hostess, speaks often of the differences between fathers and mothers and how children need both to learn different skills for adulthood. Mothers teach connectedness and relationships. Fathers teach risk-taking and enterprise. I thought that was an interesting observation, but I didn't really buy into it until my oldest son got a ticket for doing 85 miles per hour in a 55-mile zone. He was driving my underpowered Japanese mini truck at the time. His mother asked him, did he have any of his friends in the back? She was concerned about their safety, relationships, connectedness, a rightful and typically feminine concern. Before he could answer, I butted in and asked him how he got my truck to go 85 miles an hour. Risk-taking, adventure, a typically masculine concern, not necessarily rightful. Yes, we're different, and yes, Dr. Laura, he was disciplined. I burned his driver's license, or tried to. The darn thing was encased in plastic, and all I could do was blacken it and make the edges crinkle. He got to laughing, then I and his mother did. But his grades in school came up, and he had fun explaining to the motor vehicle division why his license was burned and why he needed a new one. Now, let's take a look at equality between the sexes, as has been pursued in the latter half of the 20th century, particularly in the United States. Is true, literal equality what women want and need in all areas of human life? Zero tolerance? Does it need to be rethought? True, women should vote, earn the same pay for the same work, be able to enroll in the same schools and take the same courses and pursue the same careers as men. There should be true equality before the law, with women owning and deciding what to do with property, just as men traditionally have been able to do. I have no problem. Indeed, I support these concepts, and they have been largely achieved as this 21st century rolls on. But equality in all walks of life, straight across the board. I remember when I worked construction, building apartments in Salem, Oregon, back in 1978. There was a woman who was part of a sheetrock crew. Instead of being paid by the hour, they were paid by the number of square feet they hung. To start their day, they had to manhandle 4x8 or 4x12 pieces of sheetrock up two flights of stairs so they'd have a supply in the room with which to start. The female stood idly by, sipping coffee, while the men hauled their loads and hers up the stairs. She was too small to participate in that activity. That stuff is heavy lifting. Hauling her load up the stairs, as well, cut into the time and the paycheck of the male installers. Did these guys resent the equality manifest in this operation? You bet they did. Can't say that I blame them. A zero-tolerance policy towards equality differences in the 70s and 80s by feminists is having disastrous consequences for women today. Much of that silliness has been quietly swept under the rug. When was the last time we saw female weightlifters idolized for the muscles they were building up? That was just flat grotesque. Good riddance. We say that men and women are different, but how does that work out on the spiritual plane? An interesting view of male-female relationships in the spirit world is given in The Eternal Journey, previously cited Lundahl and Whittison. A rather rebellious and disobedient young man suffers a near-death experience and is brought to a trial of sorts with a distant person on a throne acting as overseer and his grandfather and grandmother acting as prosecuting and defending attorneys, as it were. Quote, the trial was to determine whether or not I would be allowed to continue in this life, based upon whether I would do the things I was supposed to do and cease transgressing. His grandfather didn't think he'd be able to. However, his grandmother, quote, took my defense and said that she thought that I would, and she said I should be given the chance to prove that I could do this, end quote. His grandmother carried the day. His grandfather was convinced, as was the higher authority on the throne, and he came back to earth for another shot. Pages 186 through 187. We learn from this that women are given active roles in the eternities, and even listened to the point of one man changing his mind, and another, apparently some kind of judge, agreeing with her. And why not? Women, I think it can be said, are more spiritually oriented than men. To ignore feminine input and counsel is to deprive oneself of serious and important information that probably won't show up on the rather basic and faulty male radar. As I write this, 2018, there's quite a bit of controversy with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints over our refusal to give females the priesthood. Before I proceed, let me repeat my caution from the introduction. I am not an official spokesperson for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and anything I say here is my own opinion and take on these matters, not official church policy or teachings. My argument mainly goes that women have their gifts, men have theirs. The sexes are different, and the gifts God gives to them reflect and play upon these differences. What could women possibly have that would be the equivalent of priesthood power? Most, at least, have the gift of creating new life. New in terms of a mortal body for an eternal spirit child. Men don't have that gift. Does motherhood equal priesthood? Of these two gifts, though different, is one lesser than the other? Inferior? I like to think that I was a good father. I changed a lot of diapers, bathed a lot of babies, fed and nourished them, cared for them, helped them with homework and school projects, coached little league teams, built projects in the garage, and so forth. Yet the bond I have with them will never hold a candle to the bonds they have with their mother. That's just the way it is. They say that on a battlefield, when bombs and shells are falling, there's a death and mayhem everywhere. Buddies are being killed and dismembered, and the threat of death is as imminent as one's next breath. Hardened soldiers, experienced killers, cry out for their mothers. They never cry out for their fathers. They cry out for their mothers. No matter how good a father is, he'll never be cried out for under those circumstances. The mother-child bond is that strong and that eternal. If women were to have the priesthood as well, what need then of males and a special gift for them? Where would we be unique? Where would we have gifts to offer the human race special to our sex? Men will never have that gift of a bond as special as the mother-child relation. In a cosmos where women also had priesthood power, there would be two sexes. One would have priesthood power, males, and the other would have priesthood power and procreative bonding powers to their children, females. There would be no equality, just redundancy. One sex having gifts A and B, the other sex having only gift B. What kind of a system is that? And where is the fairness, the equality? God gives different gifts to his children based on their gender nature, just as we do. Consider a set of twins, boy and girl. The budget for Christmas gifts is $100 each. Mom buys her twin son a football helmet, a team jersey, and a couple video games. She buys her daughter makeup, clothes, and accessories. Has she treated her two children differently? Yes. Unfairly? No. She has given them gifts according to their gender and resultant needs and interests. Supposing she now spends an extra $100 on the girl, buying her a football helmet, team jersey, and video games so she'll be the same as her son. Is that fair? Will the girl use those things? Two of the gifts God gives exclusively or largely to his daughters are the gifts of motherhood and beauty. And beauty is not to be trivialized. Where would our lives be without beauty? What if all flowers were one color, beige? What if all butterflies were one color, white? Henry David Thoreau, author of Walden Pond, wrote this regarding beauty in his last book, Faith in a Seed, page 144. Quote, "For whatever we have perceived to be in the highest degree beautiful is of infinitely more value to us than what we have only as yet discovered to be useful and to serve our purpose." Quote, that places beauty above utility, and I agree with Thoreau. And it is women who bring beauty into our lives. For this they are not inferior, but are vital additions to the life of the human race. One might say that there is no equality now. True, women don't get the priesthood, but men don't get that special parent-child connection. Equality wherein everyone is the same is nonsense. Women and men are different. We have equality in eternal terms, in that each sex has its special gifts and abilities, and together we become one. If women had the priesthood, they would be one on their own and would have no need for men. Men can't have children and need women in their lives for that purpose, as well as many other needs, which I won't go into now. But I've always maintained that the sexes complement and supplement each other. I observed my daughter-in-law, Jen, with Dylan, my grandson, when he was an infant. The constant attention she gave him, the arranging of his blankets and clothes so he didn't get exposed to a cool breeze or a burning Arizona sun. In just 1 minute's time, I'll bet she lavished at least 4 attentions on him. 60 minutes to the hour, he was awake probably 8 hours a day then, more as he grew. That would be 240 connections per hour, roughly estimating, or about 1,000 a day. A gentle kiss, a touch, a monitoring of his facial expressions and bodily exertions, words of love, sympathy, empathy, encouragement, and recognition. As she holds him next to her breast, he can feel the source of life and nourishment and reconnect with the heartbeat that he heard in the womb for 9 months. All of this builds, brick by brick, a relational bond that will be eternal. And where's his dad? Away, working to provide for his family. But does Dylan know that? At 1 month? Of course not. And Corey, his dad, is as loving and attentive a father as I ever was, changing diapers, holding, kissing, and caressing. Dylan is blessed with excellent parents. He's a lucky little boy. And if, God forbid, he's ever in a war situation with bombs exploding, shells falling, shrapnel ripping air, clothes, and flesh, friends and companions being torn to bits and killed, Dylan will call out for his mother. And rightly so. And some females want priesthood power in addition to that. Do we not see the sins of covetousness and ingratitude arising here? And as I stated, let me close this argument with the disclaimer that I speak not officially for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but only on my own. Betty Edie's near-death experience helped her understand and appreciate her femininity. She states simply as to the role of men as counselors and judges in the cosmos, quote, "They had their roles, and I had mine," end quote. Embraced by the Light, previously cited, page 111. It's really as simple as that. No inequality, no inferiority, just difference. Difference isn't inherently inequality or unfairness. As they're deciding Betty Edie is to go back, she is interviewed by a council of 12 men. She makes a point of being a rather feminist-oriented person, and would have, before her near-death experience, been put off by an all-male council judging her. But she writes, quote, "I was learning to have a new perspective about the differing roles of men and women. I had seen then the differences between Adam and Eve. I was shown that Adam was more satisfied with his condition in the garden, and that Eve was more restless. I was shown that she wanted to become a mother fervently enough that she was willing to risk death to obtain it. Eve did not fall to temptation as much as she made a conscious decision to bring about conditions necessary for her progression, and her initiative was used to finally get Adam to partake of the fruit." Previously cited, page 109. A by-the-numbers approach to equality is giving that principle a bad name. For example, consider restrooms in a public facility, such as an auditorium. If men and women have an equal number of bathrooms, then equality by the numbers prevails. But at intermission time, one sees long lines of women outside their facilities, whereas men can just walk into their areas and have their needs immediately met. There is equality of facilities, but not of needs being met. Usually more females will go to auditorium-style events, plus women by nature need more time in the restrooms. True equality would be to meet the differing needs of male and female in these respects, and disregard the by-the-numbers equality. In a talk given at a FAIR conference, F-A-I-R, being an independent organization devoted to LDS apologetics, Valerie Hudson Carter further describes equality in an appropriate setting. Quote, "Men and women are equals before the Lord and before each other. Now, don't use the fallen world sense of the term equal. Equal does not mean identical." She further quotes LDS Apostle L. Tom Perry. Quote, "There is not a president and vice president in a family. We have co-presidents working together eternally for the good of the family. They are on equal footing." Professor Carter, a poli-sci professor at BYU, was named one of the 100 top global thinkers of 2009 by Foreign Policy magazine. So it's no small potatoes we're quoting here in Cosmos. Nothing but the best for my readers. Take, for example, the feminist view of equality in matters of sex and the great harm it is doing to our young women. You think I'm kidding? Next time you're in the checkout line at the grocery, check out the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine, published and edited by feminists, or Hugh Hefner, I'm never quite sure, what with their standard monthly cover girl showing marvelous cleavage, and tell me how the articles in the latest edition differ from those of last month, last year, last decade. They are mind-numbingly the same. Quote, 10 new ways to turn your man on in bed. Take 20 pounds off your butt. Excite him in ways you never dreamed of. And so on ad infinitum ad nauseam. This is feminism. This is equality. This is all feminism has to offer our women after 50 years of politics, demonstrations, lawsuits, and campaigning. It's destroying our girls. Women, it's time for you to get a new vision, a new view of yourselves, who you really are, and what femininity is all about. Surely, surely, there is more to being female than finding new ways to bring a man to an orgasm. Until you find a purpose in life beyond the capability of a blow-up doll sex toy, you haven't taken the first step towards being truly feminine and truly equal with men. The theory which I feel has done women the most harm is trying to get them to be sexually active, like men, trying to force women into the male mold of being able to have quickie hookups and multiple partners has done much harm to females. Example, a female student at Duke University wrote of her sexual encounters with many of the males there. Reading between the lines on her slideshow-type presentation is a sad commentary on how the feminist sexual revolution has turned women into the playthings and tools of heartless, boorish, unfeeling males more than ever before. How ironic. Wasn't that what the feminist movement was supposed to change? From Atlantic Magazine, January-February 2011, pages 87 through 96, an article by Caitlin Flanagan details the descent from respectable human female to a contemptible sex toy used and used up by the worthless males at Duke University. In a PowerPoint presentation that went viral, she details her sexual encounters with 13 Duke University athletes, most of them lacrosse players. She is described as, quote, "a young woman who was desperate for human connection and who had no idea how to obtain it." Page 88. That, right away, illustrates a major difference between male and female approaches to sex. Males want a quick and easy orgasm. Women want human connection. I wish I could say higher things for my gender, but few males rise above groin level when it comes to sex. Because of the overpowering physical neediness of the male, any trick, lie, ploy, or means will be used to get the woman into bed with him. Playing on her need for human connection and a relationship is a major artifice for the calculating male. When he's satisfied, she means no more to him than an empty hamburger wrapper. Flanagan says of this co-ed, quote, "If what we are seeing in her is the realization of female sexual power, then we must at least admit that the first pancake off the griddle is a bit of a flop. Page 89. The co-ed writes, after a one-night stand with a boy who satisfied himself in a few minutes, then just walked away and refused to see her again, that being treated like a whore by him was what broke her heart and spirit. Flanagan notes, quote, "You may not be the brave new face of anything at all," end quote, on page 94. And I might add that whores at least have a business sense and come away from the encounter with a few dollars, which is most certainly not to advocate prostitution, but it seems to me that the world's oldest profession has at least that much over feminism. Here's a feminist perspective of this tragic, used-up co-ed at Duke. Penelope Trunk, author and writing on a CBS website, writes of her, quote, "I wish I had been taking control of male tools." One's jaw drops at the potential of a double entendre here. "When I was that young, I am 20 years older than her, but she inspires me to be brave, take risks, and let my creativity get the best of me," end quote. Not to mention a Duke University lacrosse team lining up for oral sex, huh? Atlantic, opposite page 92, previously cited. Is Monica Lewinsky a heroine to you? You and sister admirers of this co-ed are an example of zero self-esteem and self-respect, amazingly from a generation that was force-fed a daily diet of self-esteem in the public school system and at the hands of modern parents. Talk about a philosophy blowing up in your face. A bit of honesty from the co-ed does surface at the end of the article. A reporter asks her for her thoughts on all that happened. Quote, "She responded with a fully human and entirely feminine sentiment. I regret it," she said, "with all my heart." End quote. Page 96. In that same Atlantic magazine, Flanagan is followed with an article by Natasha Vargas Cooper, pages 97 through 106. "There can be no true equality in terms of sameness between males and females when it comes to sex. Sex for pure physical satisfaction is male turf, ladies. When you play that game, you're playing on his home court, and all the odds are against you." Vargas Cooper writes, quote, "In each new sexual negotiation a woman has with a man, she begins at a disadvantage because the potential losses are always greater for her. Nature imposes much more rigorous consequences on women than on men. That's not equal. That's not fair. But it is life. It is reality. Life is under no obligation to conform to the theories and ideas of woke correctness. You'll have as much luck trying to get the sun to rise in the north tomorrow as you'll have in trying to change these paradigms. Males for millennia have had this encounter their way. It's a fact. It's the way it is. And women who don't realize it will be used, dirtied, and discarded like a Kleenex in flu season. That's how it is. It's not going to change until there is a massive spiritual maturing on the part of men. Don't hold your breath." Vargas Cooper calls the idea of women equally inhabiting the same sexual arena as a man does an, quote, "intellectual swindle that leads women to misjudge male sexuality, which they do at their own emotional and physical peril. Male desire is not a malleable entity that can be constructed through politics, language, or media. Sexuality is not neutral." Page 99. The feminist ideal that women can be the same as, equal to, men is bogus from the get-go. To ask a woman to be a carbon copy of a man is to ask her to throw away her potential, her agency, her individuality, fostered and nurtured by her heavenly parents. Don't be a carbon copy. Be your own full-color original. Sisters, don't set men up as your ideals, your goals, except for positive characteristics they may exhibit, Christ, for example. Be your own female person, the intelligence you were from the beginnings of time. Don't let feminism or the need for connection with a male at any price rob you of this. Well, the above is pretty much devoted to what being a female isn't. What is it, then? We started this chapter with a discussion of Eve. Let's continue with her. Hugh Nibley, previously cited Old Testament and related studies, traces male and female differences in roles back to the Garden of Eden. Now, whether one takes this literally, metaphorically, or both is of no matter compared to the wisdom passed on. Quote, "The tradition is that the two were often apart in the garden, engaged in separate tasks to which each was best fitted. In other words, being one flesh did not deprive either of them of individuality or separate interests and activities. Eve asked Adam if he intended to keep all of God's commandments. Of course he did. All of them? Naturally. And what, pray, was the first and foremost of these commandments? Was it not to multiply and replenish the earth, the universal commandment given to God's creatures? And how could they keep that commandment if they were separated? Eve would have been cast out of the garden for eating the fruit, and neither of them alone could have had children. It had undeniable priority over the commandment not to eat the fruit. So Adam could only admit that she was right and go along. Quote, I see that this must be so, he said. But it was she who made him see it. This is much more than a smart way of winning her point. However, it is the clear declaration that man and woman were put on the earth to stay together and have a family. That is their first obligation and must supersede everything else. Pages 88 through 89. Leon Cass observes the beginning of wisdom, previously cited, page 106. Quote, the woman's dialogue with the serpent shows that it is she, not the man, who is open to conversation, who imagines new possibilities, who reaches for improvement. Unlike the man with his desires sexually fixated upon the woman is more open to the world, to beauty, and to the possibility of wisdom. She, in short, has more than sex on the brain. Another reason, by the way, for wisdom to be feminine, as we discussed in an earlier chapter. Woman, as represented by Eve, is more actively sought it. Therefore, she has primary claim to it. In short, if it had been up to Adam, he and Eve would still be in the garden, keeping it neatly trimmed, and eating every fruit except the fruit offered on the tree of knowledge of good and evil. We'd all be stuck back in the premortal existence, looking at our wristwatches, tapping our feet, shaking our heads slowly and sadly from side to side, and sighing deeply and marking time, while our chances for progress and development are put indefinitely on hold. We have no idea how much we owe Mother Eve. In the LDS view of Eve, according to Carter previously cited, that number one, the LDS do not believe that the fall was a great tragedy. Rather, we believe that the fall was foreordained, that it was for our progression, and that in that perspective, the fall was a blessing. Number two, the LDS do not believe that Eve sinned. Transgressed, maybe, sinned, no. Number three, we also do not believe that Eve was punished for her role in partaking of the fruit, but rather rewarded. Rewarded? Come on, she and Adam were kicked out of the garden, had to till the earth and earn bread by the sweat of their brows, and to endure pain and difficulty in childbearing, and wrestle with a world full of thorns and briars, not to mention die. And here again, we need to think like God, the eschatological outlook. As to the consequences of the fall, when your child comes of age, do you see to it that he is sent off to school, away from home, to wrestle with learning, maybe bullies, teachers he doesn't like, and school cafeteria lunches? Instead of playing video games and watching TV all day, he now has to struggle with homework and school science projects. Is that a punishment, or is it a natural part of growing up to adulthood? It was the same with God. We had reached a level of spiritual maturity where we needed to go away from home to school, known as earth life or mortality. In life, there are many decisions that must be made, considering challenging and daunting consequences. Should you have surgery, going under anesthesia, having your body cut into? Should you go away to college, away from the familiar confines of home, family, and friends? Should you move across country to take a new job, thereby leaving behind security and, again, perhaps friends and family? The same is true with our eternal lives, and it was with Eve, not Adam, who opened the door to these new adventures and educations. However, is Eve to be subordinate to Adam, or, by extension, women subordinate to men? In January of 2018, a blog from fairmormon.org came to my attention. It seems further study has been done on Genesis, where the consequences of the fall are being explained to Adam and Eve. Quote, "And thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee," end quote. Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. It has always seemed that Eve was to be subordinate to Adam, and for justification of male rule and dominance over females. This verse is often cited. However, current scholarship gives a different spin to it. It wasn't God putting on Eve these restrictions, but rather warning Adam and Eve that now that they were in a fallen world state, the tendency to want to control the actions of others was going to be part of their lives that they'd have to deal with and avoid. So God is rather warning Eve and Adam of the problems the fall will bring to their marriage, rather than putting Eve in a subordinate position. The LDS Proclamation on Marriage and the Family states husbands and wives are to preside equally. In this, we see once again the antipathy God has towards coercion. It simply is not given to us to boss other people around, and even males bossing females around. If Eve hadn't opened the way for us, we would have been permanently stunted in our growth. Carter says of Eve and the fall, "It is through women that souls journey to mortality and gain their full agency, and in general, it is through the nurturing love of women, their nurturing love of their children, that the light of Christ is awakened in each soul. Even Christ our Lord was escorted to mortality and veiled in flesh through the gift of a woman, fed at his mother's breast, awakened to all that is good and sweet in the world. We celebrate Eve's act and honor her wisdom and courage. What she did pleased God." Previously cited. And thus we conclude this 16th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Becoming Feminine in the Cosmos, Part 2, and we'll deal with part 2 of chapter 8. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelproductions.com. That's hazelleproductions.com. Thank you.